mother's name. Where's all that religious passion? State of Texas, make a fist. State of Texas, hypocrite. Don't you know they're killing people?
Welcome to, regrettably, another Execution Watch show. You can call your friends and tell them to listen to executionwatch.org because that's the way we string this to you. We've got Gloria on the line in Huntsville. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What is going on this time?
Say what?
What is going on there?
Well, there's a large crowd of people out here, including Connie and Greg's family members. The family has gone in across the street into the death house, and looks like the execution is going to take place. We've had a rally for about an hour. People have been speaking, including Cynthia McKinney, the Green Party candidate for president, who wanted to be out here. This is the first time she's ever been to an execution, and she wanted to meet the family and give her love and solidarity to them.
Well, that sounds like you've got a bigger crowd than you have reported recently.
Yeah, there's a pretty good-sized crowd.
Okay, this is Ray Hill, and Gloria Rubeck is in Huntsville in front of the death house where there's a demonstration going on. Scheduled to be executed is Gregory Edward Wright. In 3 days, in 2 days, it would be Gregory's 43rd birthday. He received a stay previously. As a matter of fact, this show was covering that on September the 9th, and that became a breaking news story because he got a last-minute stay for some DNA evidence to be done. Gloria, do you know whether or not that DNA evidence was ever done?
The DNA testing was done, but it was still inconclusive. It showed DNA from two different people. One was Greg, and one was his co-defendant. So I guess it really still didn't prove anything.
Well, you know, this is unusual at this late stage of the game because we still have what I would call a whodunit
right
case.
So sometimes the courts won't go motions for DNA testing until late.
And
oh, it's very strange. Well, I have Cynthia McKinney standing here with me.
Well,
you. Would
put
you like to have a couple of words with
yes,
her?
Yes, put Cynthia on, please.
Okay, just one moment. Hello?
Representative McKinney?
Yes.
This is Ray Hill. We're talking to you at radio station KPFT in Houston, and we've got an execution watch program. Every time Texas kills an inmate, we do an hour program on that execution. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I thank you for doing this. It's very sad that Texas is the execution capital of the world, and that the United States itself refuses to join the League of the Community of Nations that have rejected killing their citizens through the death penalty. And I spoke with the daughter of the wife.
Are you talking?
Yeah. And she told me, I asked her, I said, do you ever think that you would be on the opposite side of justice? And she said, no. And I said, you always believed that the justice system in this country was one that truly administered justice, didn't you? And she said, yes. And so now one more American can see, unfortunately, the lack of justice. And we've got another young man in Georgia, Troy Davis, in a case where seven of the witnesses have recanted their testimony. And some of them have indicated that they were coerced into making false statements so that Troy would end up on death row.
I don't know whether to call you presidential candidate or Georgia representative. I'm a little awkward with protocol here, but you are the candidate for president of the United States on the Green Party ticket. Does the Green Party have a platform position on execution?
In fact, the Green Party has taken a stand against the death penalty. And so you're right that, yes, I'm here also wearing the hat of presidential candidate for the Green Party. But, I mean, you know, this is a case of being human.
Last week we were doing one of these shows and we were able to announce Troy got a stay. I can't tell from this distance whether a stay in Georgia is a durable one or not. What is the anticipation from closer to that case?
It's my understanding that no, this is not a durable stay in the case of Troy Davis. And so we still here assembled. With us, we have members of the Green Party, we have anti-death penalty activists, we have Amnesty International represented here. There are various journalists who are here as well, but I have to say that this is my first experience at something like this. This is my first experience seeing family members who understand the innocence of their loved one, and yet now the decision of the courts and the justice system in this country is irreversible. The family has walked across the street, and so now I would presume that the execution is underway. The state of Texas has killed yet one more soul to show the example that killing is wrong. But I noted to the people who are here that the war machine of this country is also a killer. It renders the death penalty to people and innocent people in other parts of the world, like, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Pakistan. The war machine marches on, and those who direct the war machine are able to do so with absolute, complete impunity. And even the most constitutional means, which is not a painful means at all, it certainly is, doesn't involve criminal inquest with criminal punishment, that of impeachment has been taken off the table by those who have also made themselves complicit in the U.S. military
war machine. Ms. McKinney, would you ask Lori to keep us posted? We're going to continue with other elements of this program. And thank you so again so much for joining us. I'd like to remind our listeners to this program that Green Party information about Representative McKinney and her race on the Green Party and her vice presidential candidate is available in the lobby of radio station KPFT Houston. Again, I'm Ray Hill, and I have with me the capable Jim Skelton. Jim, this is another... Is this really a whodunit at this late state in the game?
Really a bizarre case. Here's basically the situation. The lady killed in this case was a lady named Donna Vick. And she's what I guess they called a street preacher, somebody who worked with the homeless in the Dallas County area and lived in a little town called DeSoto. And Gregory Wright apparently was living with her or had some arrangements where he lived with her doing some yard work, exchange for yard work. And I never could figure out from reading the opinions whether he was homeless or what the situation was. But nonetheless, he had this relationship with her and did yard work and worked with her. And apparently, according to the way the evidence broke down, there was another street guy that was by the name of John Wade Adams. They picked up that day and went home to eat lunch. And what happened, she was stabbed to death that night. And the next day, what happened is Adams gets a hold of a guy at a video arcade and says that he wants to talk about a murder. And they called 911. The police came out and talked to Adams. And Adams, and there's a conflict exactly what he said. At one point, they claim he said, "I killed somebody. I need to get it off my chest. I feel badly about it." Then another time, the police claim that he just simply said, "I'm involved in a murder. Wanted to tell him." And based upon that, they found Miss Vick's body, and then he led them to the car, and then he led them to a place they call the Beckley Shack. It's the street on Beckley's little shack. Apparently, a lot of the homeless men hung out, and that's where they arrested Gregory Wright. And here's what they claim. Adams tells the police that what had happened on the day of the murder, he claimed that they ate dinner together. Miss Vick fixed him dinner, and that Wright says to him, "I'm going to kill her." And that, strange enough, Adams said he gave him the knife. And everybody admits the knife used in this killing belonged to Adams and not to Gregory Wright. And he claimed after they killed her, they then took a lot of her merchandise, a television set, a lawn weeder and some more things, and took them over to a crack dealer, a crack house run by a guy named Llewellyn. A guy, the last name was Llewellyn. Llewellyn Mosley was his name. And while at Llewellyn Mosley's house, they apparently pawned a lot of this stuff off. And there was later claims made that while at the crack house, that Adams admitted to another crack dealer that he, in fact, had done the killing. But nonetheless, both Adams, according to Mosley, both Adams and Wright were driving Mrs. Vick's stolen car with some of her merchandise in it. And they sold the stuff apparently for crack cocaine or got some crack cocaine while we were there at the house. And then when they arrested Wright the following day, they found a knife that had Mrs. Vick's blood on it outside this so-called shack. They found a pair of jeans that were bloody, had Mrs. Vick's blood on them. And they found a whole bunch of spray can paint, like somebody had been snorting spray can, sniffing glue. And what's interesting about the pants fit Adams and couldn't have fit Gregory Wright because he was a good deal larger. He had only 32-inch waist. And Gregory Wright was a pretty good-sized man. And so they wouldn't fit him. Obviously, they apparently belonged to Adams. And also, they found a mail and stuff there belonging to Adams. And apparently, both Adams and Wright had used this. It's kind of like a flop house. They called it the Beckley Shack. Both of them had used it. And what's interesting, the only people tying Wright to this murder is the testimony of Adams and the testimony of Mosley, the crack dealer. That's
it. Who wasn't there.
And here's what's even more interesting, and I read this primarily in the stuff that came afterwards. The only physical evidence linking Wright to the murder scene was a bloody fingerprint found on a pillow next to where this lady was stabbed. And there's an old phrase among lawyers that fingerprints don't lie, but liars take fingerprints. Well, I pulled up the application that they've submitted to the Board of Pardons and Paroles and discovered that the man who took the prints himself, a police officer, was later charged with murder. He's a fugitive from justice currently, and they can't find him.
Well, so, I mean, pillowcases generally are fabric.
Well, let me tell you what else happened. What was real interesting about this, according to the application for a pardon, they took the fingerprint that they got as a fuzzy fingerprint, and two Dallas detectives, he worked in the Dallas County Sheriff's Department Bureau, said there were not enough characteristics to make a print, a comparison with Wright's fingerprint. And they said it couldn't be done. Well, then they go out and get a retired officer who had trained these two, a guy named John Cron, C-R-O-N. And apparently, his retirement, he got to be a real wizard because he was able to do what the other two could not do. Now, you had two detectives who were currently on duty, who were currently working, they'd used for years in past. He said there were not enough characteristics in this print to tie it to Wright. But yet the retired detective, who had been retired from the Sheriff's Department, made a positive ID. And then, according to the stuff that came out of the petition to get clemency from the Board of Pardons and Paroles, they also showed what this Crone's work to another expert, and he said there's no way in the world they could compare those prints. And they talked about a deal called feathering something out where you just kind of make a wild-ass guess. And really, the only physical evidence time ting is real questionable.
Well, I mean, the bloody blue jeans obviously wouldn't have fit Wright. Would have fit Adams.
Not unless he's shrunk.
The knife belonged to Adams,
right?
Not Wright. How does a case like this get to this point? Is it a situation where the courts of appeals have just decided that all of these guys are bad and killing any one of them is justified?
I think probably obviously Adams had, I mean, Wright had something to do with it. Either he helped Adams after the killing took place, or he might have been there. Obviously, he was involved in some way.
But the evidence, I think, in an early analysis that you got is that Wright, the best analysis of the evidence, that Wright is involved after the fact.
Right. Because everything points toward Adams, because, for example, in the car, when they stole Mrs. Vick's car, Adam's billfold is found in the car. His fingerprints are found in the car. Nothing linking Wright to the car at all. It all links to Adams. The murder weapon belongs to Adams. The bloody pants belong to Adams. Billfold is found in the car of the victim. He's the one that calls the police to begin with. And usually, and that's been that old characteristic, people have talked about that for years, one of the first suspects that was suspected in a murder case is the first one that called the police. And he's the one that calls the police. And he's really the one that points the finger at Wright. Now, granted, when they go to arrest Wright at this little shack that apparently a lot of the street people have been using, he's there, and they found found two different knives. There was a knife found outside the shack, and that had some blood on it from the victim. And then Adams led him to another knife next to where the crack house was, where they took the money to hawk at the crack house.
And
what they said, apparently the pathologist said two knives could have been used because she was stabbed repeatedly over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, really, in this particular case, anybody looked at this case would assume that Adams was the one that did the killing, because he just met her that day, and it seems kind of strange that Vic would, I mean, unless there's some type of, they had some problem. He apparently knew this lady rather well enough to work with her and work around her, and Adams was the one that just was kind of the new guy on the block.
And whatever happened to the old saw that you can't execute somebody on the uncorroborated evidence of a co-indicted co-defendant?
Wright never. There was no. In this particular case, it's kind of strange. Here's what happened. They never called Adams as a witness. Now, the way all this testimony got in is one of those catch-22s. The defense lawyer wanted to be able to prove that the knife belonged to Adams.
Mm-hmm.
The only way they could prove it is through the policeman that did the investigation, who interviewed Adams initially. Because remember, what Adams did, he talked to a guy at a video store and admitted to him that he was involved in a murder. The guy at the video store called the police department. A detective comes out and interviews Adams.
Now, the person about to be executed or being executed right right now is a fellow by the name of Wright. He was obviously not Adams.
Right, I'm sorry. Well, Adams is the one that did the calling.
Yeah.
And so what Adams, when the police went out and talked to Adams, Adams is the one that claimed that Wright did all the killing, the guy they're about to execute. He claimed he was the one that did the murder. And so what happened, he also admitted the murder weapon belonged to him. So when they had the detective on the stand, the defense lawyer wanted to bring out the fact that the murder weapon belonged to Adams and not to Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to bring this point out. So he did bring that point out. The problem is there's a rule, a deal called the rule of optional completeness. When you bring out a part of a conversation, the other side is eligible to come in and get in the rest of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So once the defense lawyer proved up that the knife belonged to Adams, it's permitted the state to come back. What did Adams tell you? And
yeah,
that's how they got in front of the jury, Adams' statement.
So Adams actually never did testify in Wright's trial.
No, all he did, the detective who interviewed Adams told the jury what Adams told him under what we call the rule of optional completeness, because the defense lawyer was the one that, in a sense, the old phrase that lawyers use is open the door. And he had to make a calculated risk. He wanted the jury to know the murder weapon didn't belong to his client. But when he made that revelation known through the detective, then the detective is eligible to say what else Adams told him about the murder, and that's how the evidence came in.
What says the rest of the history of the appeals?
What happened is they went up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they affirmed, and it's a whole bunch of stuff they talked about the Court of Criminal Appeals, and primarily they talked about the lawyer being, about the lawyer not making a confrontation objection when the testimony, when the detective testified as to what Adams told him. That objection was never made at trial. They just simply objected on hearsay, and they overruled that and didn't make a ruling that it was a denial of the right of confrontation. And the rest of it is primarily about jury selection. Then they affirmed it. It was a unanimous verdict. There's one concurring opinion. Judge Johnson wrote the majority opinion. And then after it was affirmed, they came back in on a writ claiming the lawyer was ineffective, and they primarily argued about the fact that he did not object about the confrontation rule. I thought where the lawyer, if the lawyer did mess up, what I would have done had it been me trying the case, I would have called those two detectives that said the print did not match, and I'd have made a gigantic issue out of the fact that you had two active detectives saying the print didn't match. Plus, they had a defense expert who looked at that print, and I would have called those three witnesses to have rebutted the state's evidence on the fingerprint.
But that was not done.
It's never done.
That was not done. A little later in the program, we're going to have interview Professor Mary Penrose, who is from Oklahoma, who participated in some of the appeals, I guess at the writ level. I'm bewildered by this. I mean, when we start looking into these cases, it's been our experience, both you and me, in the last few weeks, that looking at these cases, we can see where the system has blundered through. Is that your impression?
Well, it seems to me there should be. I would have granted a stay in this case for a couple of two more reasons that brought out in the application for clemency. Apparently, they polygraphed Wright here fairly recently, and he passed a polygraph that he had nothing to do with the murder. In fact, they had the specific questions, the application for clemency, did you stab her? No, I didn't. And then he scored a 7 on the polygraph test.
Oh my God.
And then you've had a couple of people have come forward giving affidavits. One guy on death row who claimed Adams finally admitted to him that he committed the murder. And here's what's even more bizarre. Unsolicited. Now, Adams also was tried later in a separate trial. He got the death penalty, so he's currently on death row. And what's interesting about this is while he's been on death row, while his appeal was pending, he wrote an unsolicited letter to Wright's lawyer admitting that he, Adams, had committed the murder and that what he initially told the police was not true. So they got his written, and he's also made this admission to a person in jail, and also made the admission to a guy at the crack house that he was the one that did the killing. The problem is, the lawyer, it's kind of like that. Remember back when Judge Woods got killed, the federal judge, and one of the clients wrote a letter of apology to the widow and said, I'm sorry we did it, and the lawyer had a heart attack? But the same token, apparently after Adams wrote Wright's lawyer and said what I told the police was a lie and not true, at that point he didn't back away from his statement. He's refused to put it under oath and refused to testify to this under oath because he still had appeals pending. So if his case gets reversed on appeal, they can use that admission against him on a retrial.
Okay, I think this is Gloria. Hello, Gloria?
Hello?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What has happened?
The execution is over. Greg Wright has been murdered. His family is in tears, collapsing out here. And it's a very sad scene that gets replayed over and over and over again in this damn place.
Well, that's right on time with the pattern we have. Here it is 6:25, and it's a fait accompli.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank your impressions?
Oh, mercy. What is this, 420 we're at now?
Yeah.
Now we have another family that is just collapsing in grief. Interesting. Ron Carlson is here. His sister was murdered by Carlos A. Tucker.
Yeah.
He's in an embrace with Connie Wright's daughter right now.
Well, he actually
Carlos A.'s execution, and he still comes out here to protest.
Yeah, he was opposed to the execution of Carla Faye in its time, wasn't he?
Huh?
Wasn't he opposed to the execution of Carla Faye at the time?
Right. Yeah, he sure did. And he had spoken out in support of Shaka.
Yeah.
Also. And he's part of Murder Victims Family for Reconciliation.
Right.
And, he's been a faithful... He's been out here many times this summer, even though he had knee surgery. Came out here one time on crutches.
Well, Gloria, give our condolences to the family, our encouragement for the other folks there at the demonstration, and of course our thanks to Cynthia.
What you do.
And our thanks to Cynthia, please.
Oh, okay.
And Gloria, the archives of all of these shows are available at executionwatch.org.
I will announce that on the mic right now.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was our reporter. And we had another reporter, actually, in Huntsville. We have Nancy Bailey. Why don't you see if you can get Nancy on? Nancy has spent the day with Gregory Wright's wife, Connie. And if we can reach her, she may be consoling Connie right now, but if she's available, we can talk about her impressions of what has happened today. Still remaining in the show is a call to Professor Mary Penrose from Oklahoma College of Law and a call to Peter Bellamy in the United Kingdom to talk to him about his correspondence with the now late Gregory Wright. Okay, we're about ready to go. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Nancy.
How are you doing?
This is Nancy Bailey, who is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and she's also a regional coordinator for Amnesty International Houston's chapter. Nancy, what have you been doing all day?
Well, we have just been out on the corner while they've executed Gregory Wright, and the family has just come out of the building, and they're on their way back to the hospitality house and then over to the funeral home. It's a terrible thing.
Now, you spent most of the day with Connie.
Well, I met her at about 1:30 and at the hospitality house, and they have an orientation where they tell them what to expect and just visit with them over there until time to go over to for the execution. And at 5:00, they took them over to the administrative building in front of Walls. And they told them at the orientation that they would not be walked across until all appeals were done. And so at 5 until 6, they walked them across. And so they just now walked out, just not even a minute ago.
Well, this work is very taxing on you. I can tell it by the tone of your voice. Give us your impressions of...
It's very stressful.
And
going back over to the... After they go to the hospitality house, they're supposed to give them all of Greg's belongings. And then they'll be over to the funeral home, where they'll be allowed to see him for 15 minutes. And... then that's it. They will be having a funeral for Greg on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Where?
I can't remember if it's the Presbyterian Church. I cannot remember. I'll have to check that and post it. But Honey has authorized me to invite anybody who would like to attend that funeral.
And
it's on 190 in Livingston, just a few buildings past the post office going...
So it's a church in Livingston. Nancy, if you can get that to me via email, I will make the announcement on the prison show Friday.
Okay, I will. It'll be tomorrow before I send it to you because
that's fine.
I'm going to be up here pretty late.
As long as I can get it before showtime.
Okay.
And Nancy, give our condolences to the family. And,
I certainly will. Thanks, Ray.
And let me express our appreciation for all that you do.
Well, I appreciate everything you do, too, Ray. We just couldn't get along without you.
Thank you, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Nancy Bailey from Amnesty International and the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And so why don't we see if we can get Professor Penrose on. You got a music segue. We're going to put a music segue and we'll be right back with Professor Penrose to talk about some of her efforts in the appeal in just a flash. You're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston, the HD2 channel, but actually you're getting it over the internet via kpft.org, executionwatch.org, and the prison show. .org websites. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back shortly. Okay. This guy just called. Cut was from Dead Man Walking, cut 5. It's I can't pronounce the name, Musrat Feda Akan, with Eddie Vedder, In the Face of Love. The album was assembled by Stevie Ray on the occasion of Dead Man Walking. We have Professor Mary Penrose from Oklahoma College of Law on the phone. Hello, Professor, are you there?
I'm here.
You worked on this case. By the way, they just completed the execution of Gregory Edward Wright. In working on what level of the appeals did you participate?
Bruce Anton and I both represented Greg for about the last 8 years. We were the federal habeas appellate lawyers, and so we represented him the U.S. District Court, then before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, then the United States Supreme Court. But because his case had some DNA issues and the co-defendant recanted part of his statements and began indicating that Greg was factually innocent of the crime, we were also working in the state court and prepared and pursued a state habeas writ, which those are the pleadings that were denied over the last 48 hours.
Was it a surprise to you that they were denied?
I think it was a disappointment, but usually when you see the trial court come down a particular way, when Judge Francis, who is the trial judge here in Dallas County that ruled on the recantation and the DNA evidence, when he ruled against us, usually we are pretty certain that the federal courts will only step in the rarest of circumstances. But as I said, it's very disappointing because Greg had very colorable claims of actual innocence and DNA being one of them.
Houston Attorney Jim Skelton and I have been discussing this case since the top of the hour. And from my lay objective view and his somewhat more objective view, this case was still a whodunit right up to the last minute.
And I think the whodunit will never be resolved, and I think that's the greatest tragedy. I mean, certainly we have an individual who was murdered here in Dallas.
And that was a tragedy.
And there's never been, from our perspective, anything but empathy for that family. But to put Greg Wright and cast him as the person who committed this crime when the evidence is equivocal at best. And as you said, up until 3 weeks ago when the co-defendant John Adams had sent at least three letters that were unsolicited calling into doubt Greg's guilt, and then the DNA comes back and seems to confirm that there's at least a reasonable doubt in this case, it's pretty disturbing that the state proceeded with the execution.
Do you think that these circumstances and this result is more frequent in Texas courts than elsewhere?
I really do. I mean, I certainly am troubled by the number of exonerations that have come out of the Dallas District Attorney's Office, because it leads me to believe there are more there. I believe Greg Wright's case was one of those that should have received some attention. But despite the public image that the district attorney's office wants to pursue every available claim to make sure that an innocent person is never executed, I didn't feel like my client got that benefit or that policy applied in his case.
This must be very frustrating work. What motivates you to continue it?
Well, you know, when I first began working on these cases, I actually asked that question of another lawyer who did it, and I said, how do you do it? And he said, I guess I feel like I'm on the right side of history, and I won't stop until we cease executing individuals. I mean, from my perspective, I'm certainly opposed to the death penalty. I think it's the wrong way to address violent crime. I think it creates additional victims. I think economically it's an expense that doesn't reap any rewards. I think that retribution just continues anger and frustration, and I guess I feel dedicated to wanting to eradicate the death penalty, and I think sometimes you want to create a record, and I think as you're saying, I mean, we spoke with our client this afternoon, and I think he was stunned that in the last 48 hours, no one intervened, despite the fact that there appear to be real questions of whether he was guilty. And from our perspective, as lawyers, the state chose to try Greg and his co-defendant, John Adams, separately, and they tried Greg first. And when they tried Greg, they said he was the individual who committed the murder. It was Greg. It was only Greg. He's the one who did it. And then they went and tried John Adams and took a very similar theory, rather than trying them together and saying one of these individuals did this crime. And one thing that has happened in the last filings that we had pursued over the last 48 hours is the state took a different position in trying to ensure that the execution went forward, and that's that they now changed their theory of the case to match the evidence. Now that it's obvious, because the DNA on the genes from the person that committed the murder appears to have linkage to John Adams and not our client, Greg Wright, the state changed its theory and said, well, it doesn't matter if he was the one that was actually on the victim, stabbing the victim, when in fact it did matter. That's the crime the jury found him guilty of. But the last three appeals that went up, all of them, the state took a new position on the evidence that's inconsistent with the position they took at trial.
Professor Penrose, we do not envy you your work, but we appreciate it.
Well, and I thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you tonight.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye.
That was Professor Mary Penrose of Oklahoma College of Law, and we have one other guest that we're going to try to conjure up, and this is from across the pond in England. In the meantime, Jim,
yo,
any comment on the professor's comment?
Yeah, let me explain some of the stuff about the DNA evidence. We have a very limited right to get what we call post-conviction DNA testing. You've got to be able to prove, number one, that identity is the only issue you're talking about, that you're not the perpetrator. And, for example, if you try to use it to support the thing that somebody else did the killing, you're just a party to it, you're not going to get DNA testing. Recently, we just had a case of in which a lawyer was trying to get DNA evidence to prove that his client had a good self-defense plan. They said that's not applicable. So we have a very limited right for post-conviction DNA testing in this state, because to get it, you have to literally be able to prove, to show the court that you're not involved in the crime, period. Now, in this particular case, the best they could ever get out of Wright is to prove that he might have been there when Adams did the killing, and might have helped him after the killing. And that would have made him somewhat of a party to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the DNA evidence wouldn't help him a whole lot, because it would get him as a party or as the primary actor. And like I say, our DNA, post-conviction DNA legislation is very, very, very limited.
We now have a call from England. Peter Bellamy, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Okay, Peter, you're on the air with us here on Execution Watch at KPFT Houston. And how did you know Greg Wright?
How do I know Greg Wright?
Yes, sir.
I responded to an advert in one of the magazines I have from the university, looking for pen pals, writers to people on death row, and by chance I was allocated to Craig.
Have you been corresponding with him long?
Sorry?
Have you been corresponding with him long?
I've been corresponding with him now since 2005, just over 3 years. I've sent him something like 250 letters, and I've received many from him in return.
Well, we regret to inform you that his execution is now complete, and the process is over, and Greg has been executed by the state of Texas. Something of your impressions, please.
Yes, I've been following events, and shocking, really. We had hoped, with the evidence that had been accrued recently, that he stood a good chance and would have received fairer attention than appears to have been the case.
Well, I'm certainly not going to burden you with the responsibility of speaking of all, for all the people in UK, but how does Texas execution madness impress you personally?
Sorry, I couldn't talk.
How does the madness of execution in Texas impress you from the outside?
Well, it's not very civilized, I'm afraid. You know that the European Union is very much against it, and that seems to be the trend around the world for declining use.
Except here in Texas, which is apparently...
I really think it's regrettable that the United States appears to be perhaps going to be one of the last to rid itself of this practice.
And Texas is the most aggressive at doing it.
It is indeed. Well, they seem very determined to continue, don't they?
Are you corresponding with other prisoners on death row?
I'm not at the present time, no. Greg, is, the case was very complex, as you know, and I felt very early on that there was a good chance of his innocence, and... that's occupied all my time and my energy.
Well, we just got through talking with one of his appellate lawyers from University of Oklahoma Law School and others in the case, and the common conclusion is that this case is yet to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
I would agree absolutely with that.
Well, thank you for joining us on Execution Watch. You can hear a complete replay of our show on executionwatch.org via the internet.
Right.
Thank you, sir. Well, Jim, it's back to us.
You know, the thing that, and I never could find out about this, this is not one of your typical death pattern cases. He, from
what... You've said that two or three times.
Well...
last month.
Yeah. Well, in this guy's background, though, he was raised, there's nothing about childhood abuse. He was raised in a farming middle-class community, was kind of a high school, nice-looking guy. He was a high school football, baseball, basketball star, finished 11 years of school. There was nothing to indicate, at least far as I could find in the school record and stuff that I went through, that he was ever a problem, because usually athletes, you know, are the big jocks, don't get in too much trouble except to chase cheerleaders. Other than that, that's about it.
And he spent some time as an over-the-road driver.
And after that, he was a truck driver, got married fairly young, and got a divorce, had no children. And I never could find anything about his prior criminal history. And in fact, I went through all the opinions thinking at the punishment hearing there'd be some sort of expert testimony or he had some horrible, hideous criminal past. But apparently nothing. And if what they say is true, he was, for some reason, was a homeless person, and usually when you think of a homeless person, you think of somebody with drugs or alcohol. But not every homeless person's a killer. And obviously the guy that did the killing, that would be pretty bloody, and all the blood pointed toward Adams. Because again,
it was an ex-prison gang member.
Right. And in fact, when they found the bloody pants in what they call the Berkeley Shack, it was a shack where a lot of the homeless people hung out, the blood was all in the leg area, like somebody had straddled somebody and stabbed them. And those pants obviously belonged to Adams, and they were found with some of Adams' letters as written to some white supremacist group. And, of course, Wright was at the Berkeley, what they call the Beckley Shack. He was there. And, like I say, one of the knives were there that they was used in the killing, and then Adams led him to the other knife. And I never could find anything that he'd ever had, anything about his prior criminal history, and that bothered me. And every crime is egregious, but today I just can't imagine this ever being a death penalty case because he doesn't have the criminal background. He's not one of those real horrible... What really messed up death penalty cases, truthfully? Remember the Larry O'Brien case, the candy killer?
Yeah.
See, the problem with that case was he had never been in trouble in his life and never had a traffic ticket ever. And they had to prove...
A big church member.
Well, yeah, what he was doing, and here's what was crazy. He was stealing money from TSO to give money to his church to be a big shot.
Yeah.
He was fixing to be exposed. Mm-hmm. He had to come up with the money to pay TSO.
So he killed
his own kid for insurance money. to save his, you know. Sure. And then what happened, the real problem from a lawyer viewpoint, how do you prove future dangerousness? Because the only thing he ever did was kill his own kid. He never had a traffic ticket, didn't have anything wrong. So what they did, in order to justify giving him the death penalty, they said you can take the conduct of the crime itself, just that act alone, and predict future dangerousness. So in a real heinous crime, you can take, for example, we've had several where a guy kills two or three people and rapes the widow, some real bad stuff they did.
Some of the cases we've dealt with recently.
Some real bad stuff. This, I'm not saying, you know, as far as a murder goes, stabbing this, stabbed somebody to death and took their merchandise. That's not particularly egregious when you start looking at the whole spectrum of capital murder cases. And I can't think, there was no testimony that he was, from experts saying he was sociopathic. There's nothing about his background that was brought out at the punishment hearing. I'm just amazed they sought the death penalty in this case. If this was tried today, there's no way in the world they'd seek the death penalty in this case unless he had a real bad criminal history I'm unaware
of. Well, you know, this case leads you to speculate on a lot of things. My speculation is that he got into truck driving as a profession, as an honorable profession. I've had relatives that drove trucks.
And they got the meth.
And he got into you know, over-the-road speed.
Yeah, very well could be.
Which could easily be dispensed at truck stops and is dispensed at truck stops. But only his addictive personality was such that there was never enough.
And the paint sniffing's odd because usually that's with young kids or the paint sniffers, you know.
Yeah,
the
so
glue
you gotta,
sniffers.
You've got to have a pretty serious habit to be sniffing paint at 30 years old.
Something's wacko because obviously I would imagine he had some crack problems because when they go to the crack house afterwards, I mean, that indicates being homeless indicates somebody that's a crack addict. But the paint sniffing, was I just found that real bizarre because that's usually what young teenage kids do.
Yeah.
I just thought I just can't imagine this being a death penalty case today if it were tried today. Unless there's something about his criminal history that was never brought up.
Show up in the record?
There wasn't even, I couldn't even find any indication there was everybody that said he had a bad reputation for being a bad person in punishment. It was just really bizarre. The only thing they indicate that might have been some impetus. Adams, when he claimed they go to the crack house after the murder, they claim they kill the lady, steal all of her merchandise, go to the crack house. According to Adams, they're giving each other high fives after they're selling her merchandise and kind of laughing about things.
The selling her merchandise, the theft made the difference between a capital and not. If they'd just killed her, but they killed her and stole it.
Then the course of a robbery. What converts us, what a robbery is killing somebody during the course of theft. So it's a robbery, murder, what it amounts
and
to.
And that makes the difference between capital and
non-capital. Exactly.
In some jurisdictions, in some cases. But you're not saying that's not the issue here. The issue here is this wouldn't meet muster by today's capital punishment standard.
No, because it's not usually today. You have to have a real egregious crime, like the one we had where the guy killed three people in a restaurant and raped the widow. That's pretty bad stuff. And or you have to have somebody who has got a long history of criminal deviant behavior. Like you had testimony one last week where they said the guy would repeat again. They called experts, and he'd likely be a danger to society. That society would be in danger if he wouldn't put away a bad pedophile. Now you don't have any of that sort of testimony here. You've got homeless people who got involved with a lady who was ministering to the homeless, killed her, stole her merchandise, and it just today wouldn't, unless there's something about this case I'm unaware of, and especially in view of the fact that after it's over with, you have at least three people coming forward claiming Adams admitted to them that he did the killing. And what makes it even more bizarre is the fact that you have Adams unsolicited. While his case is on appeal, knowing it could be used against him on the benefit of a retrial, now he's been given the death penalty too, writing an unsolicited letter to Wright's lawyer saying, look, what I told the police initially was a lie.
And that lawyer we had on from Oklahoma Law School said that there had been three such letters.
I only know of one.
Yeah.
There may very well could be three. I know there, and then a cellmate claimed that he told him the same thing. Then we had a guy at the crack house who said that Adam said the same thing, and there's a real controversy on what he told. And why would he have called?
Now, Adams is doing life for the same case.
No, he got the death sentence, didn't he?
He got the death sentence?
He's on death row, as I understand
it. If Adams is on death row, then this is, everybody goes.
Everybody goes. Everybody goes. And also another big issue on the appeal, the Mosley, the guy that took the crack stuff to, they raided his house the following day after the killings, after the murder. And they claimed he got him cut some deal with the state to testify, but they never were able to prove that he got a deal cut with the state to testify. And then they horse raised that, but they were never able to prove that on any type of rents that Mosley had some secret deal.
Well, thank you, Jim.
You're more than welcome.
I'm Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. Our able producer is Elizabeth Stein, who does all the work putting these shows together. Of course, we couldn't make it without Otis McClay, the wizard and the technical editor and producer of each of these shows. If you are listening to this show, please be advised that we've mentioned previous programs. You can get those off of executionwatch.org, where an archive of all of these shows are kept. You might ask your friends to listen in and see Texas Execution as it progresses. Again, that's on executionwatch.org. I want to thank our guest. It was Professor Mary Pimrose of the Oklahoma College of Law, Peter Bellamy from the United Kingdom, who has corresponded with Greg for some 5 years. Our reporter in Huntsville was the very disappointed and exasperated Gloria Ruback, and of course Nancy Bailey joined us as well. Always in the studio to help us with this is Dan Grunstrom, who's a volunteer on The Prison Show. We will be there tomorrow night with the latest information about Texas prisons. I am Ray Hill. This is KPFT.org. On next Thursday, November the 6th, just 2 days after an election, Texas plans to put to death Elkie Taylor. And you can hear it at the same location that you're listening to this on executionwatch.org, kpft.org, or theprisonshow.org. I'm Ray Hill. Good night.
I was fresh out of the service, it was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could become.